Lecture 3 of the Foundations of Human Experience, a lecture cycle by Rudolf Steiner, the synopsis of Lecture 3. A comprehensive view of cosmic laws as a basis for being a teacher. The duality of the human being is the greatest error of modern psychology. The misleading law of the conservation of energy, the formation of new energy and matter in the human being. Understanding what is dying in nature through the intellect, and what is becoming through the will. How perceiving the eye is based in the physical body. Freedom and sense-free thinking. Nature without the human being, the danger of extinction. The function of the human corpse for the development of the earth. The prevalence of death-bringing forces in the dead bones and dying nerves, and life-giving forces in the blood and muscles. Rickets. The relationship of geometry to the skeleton. Geometry is a reflection of cosmic movements. The human being is not an observer of the world, but its quote-unquote stage. The creation of new matter and forces through the touching of blood and nerves. Concerning the scientific method, postulates... Concerning the scientific method, postulates instead of universal definitions. I guess the word is postulates instead of universal definitions. End of synopsis. Lecture 3, given in Stuttgart, August 23rd, 1919. Behind everything they do in school, modern teachers must hold a comprehensive view of cosmic law. It is obvious that education, particularly in the lower grades, requires that the teacher's soul have a relationship to the highest ideals of humanity. One reason for the current illness in education is that we have held teachers of the lower grades in a kind of dependency. We have viewed their work as less valuable than that of teachers in the higher grades. It is not my intention to discuss the general question of the cultural activity of the social organism at this time. However, we must note that in the future we must view all teachers as equal, and the public must feel that teachers of the lower grades are just as worthy as teachers of the higher grades, particularly regarding their spiritual character. Thus it will come as no surprise today when we consider what even teachers of the lower grades must know without fail, although they cannot use it directly with the children. It must, however, stand behind all teaching that is to be fruitful. In teaching, we bring the child the natural world, on the one side, and on the other, the spiritual world. As human beings, we have a relationship with the natural world, on the one hand, and the spiritual world, on the other, insofar as we are earthly creatures and exist physically between birth and death. Modern psychology is quite weakly developed. Psychology in particular suffers from the after-effects of the Catholic dogma promulgated in 869, which obscured an older insight based in instinctive knowledge, namely the insight that human beings consist of body, soul, and spirit. From modern psychology you hear almost nothing but talk of a simple two-part human being. You hear that people consist only of body and soul, or flesh and spirit, depending upon what you want to call it. People regard flesh and body, or spirit and soul, as essentially the same thing. Nearly all psychological theories result from the error of the two-part nature of the human being. It is not possible to achieve real insight into human nature if we accept only these two parts as real. Thus, in principle, nearly everything that appears today in psychology is quite amateurish, often only a play on words. All this is the result of that great error, which became so significant in the second half of the 19th century because people totally misunderstood a genuinely great achievement of physical science. You may be aware that the good citizens of Heilbronn have erected in the middle of their city a statue of a man who in his lifetime was locked in an insane asylum, Julius Robert Mayer. Of course you know that we associate this man, of whom the people of Heilbronn are quite proud today with the so-called law of conservation of energy. This law states that the amount of all energy or forces within the universe is a constant, and that these forces are only transformed so that, for instance, a force appears at one time as heat, at another time as mechanical energy, and so forth. However, Mayer's law appears in this form only when it is fundamentally misunderstood. What was important for Mayer was the discovery of the metamorphosis of forces, not the creation of such an abstract law as the law of conservation of energy. When viewed broadly, what is the significance of the law of conservation of energy for our civilization? It is the main hurdle to understanding the human being at all. When we believe that forces are never created, we can no longer achieve an understanding of true human nature. We can find the true essence of humanity in just the fact that through human beings, new forces are continually created. In the world in which we live, human beings are the only beings in whom new forces, and as we will hear later, even new matter, are formed. However, because the current worldview is incapable of accepting thoughts through which we can fully recognize the human being, people come along with this law of conservation of energy. In a certain sense, this law disturbs nothing if we look only at the other kingdoms of nature, the mineral, plant, and animal kingdoms, but it immediately destroys all real understanding when we attempt to get close to human nature. As teachers, you will need to make nature understandable to your pupils and at the same time guide them to a comprehension of spiritual life. Without being familiar, at least to a certain extent, with nature and without a relationship to spiritual life, people today cannot become part of social life. Let us now first turn our attention to nature. Nature presents itself to us in such a way that we face it, on the one side, with our ideas and thoughts, which, as you know, are pictorial in character and are a kind of reflection of prenatal life. On the other side, we face nature with something that is of a will character and implies a germ of our life after death. It continuously directs us toward nature. That, of course, seems to indicate that nature exists in two parts, which has brought forth the erroneous view that human beings consist of only two parts. We will come back to this shortly. If we turn our thinking and ideas only toward nature, then we can comprehend only what is continuously dying there. This is a particularly important principle. You should be quite clear that when you learn those beautiful laws of nature that have been discovered with the help of reason and the power of reflective thinking, those laws always relate to what is in the process of dying. When the germinal living will turns toward nature, it experiences something quite different from those natural laws based upon what is dead. Because you still carry many ideas that have arisen from the present time and the errors of modern conventional science, you will probably have difficulty in understanding that. What brings our senses, parenthesis, in the full spectrum of the 12 senses, parenthesis, into relationship with the outer world is not of a cognitive but of a willing nature. Modern people have completely lost that insight. When they read in Plato that the actual basis of seeing is the reaching out of a kind of tentacle to the things seen, they think it is something childish. Of course, these tentacles are not perceptible with the normal senses, but Plato's awareness of their existence indicates he had penetrated the supersensible world. The way we see things is, in fact, nothing more than a more refined The way we see things is, in fact, nothing other than a more refined process, similar to grasping things with our hands. For example, picking up a piece of chalk is a physical process, very similar to the spiritual process that occurs when you radiate etheric forces from your eyes to grasp an object through seeing. If modern people could observe anything, they would be able to derive such facts from observations of nature. If, for example, you look at the eyes of a horse and the way they are directed outward, then you will feel that simply through the position of its eyes, the horse is in a different relationship to its surroundings than a human being is. We can best make the reason for the difference clear by the following hypothetical situation. Imagine that your arms were such that it was impossible for you to cross them in front of you. You would always remain at the eurythmic position of ah, and could never come to oh, because you could not bring your arms together in front of you. Concerning the supersensible, quote-unquote, arms of its eyes, the horse is in the same situation. The, quote-unquote, arms of its left eye can never touch those of its right eye. Human beings, due to the position of their eyes, are able to allow these supersensible arms to touch one another. That is the basis of the supersensible sense of the eye, capital I. Were we never able to touch right and left, or were this touching to have the minimal importance it has with animals that cannot, for example, use their forefeet for prayer or other similar spiritual activity, we could never achieve a spiritual sense of ourself. What is important for the sensitivity in the eye and ear is not so much the passive element, but the active element that we extend to things through the will. Modern philosophy has often had a notion of something correct and has created all kinds of words that in general only prove how far it is from grasping what is correct. We find in the quote-unquote attributes of Lotze's philosophy an indication of his recognition of the activity of the will sense life. However, our sense organism is of a willing nature, particularly the senses of touch, taste, and smell, which are very clearly connected with the metabolism in a higher sense. Thus we can say that when human beings intellectually confront nature and comprehend what is dead, then these dead laws become a part of them. However, people comprehend what raises nature above death and becomes the world's future by means of an apparently undefinable will that extends back into the senses. Think about how alive your relationship to nature will be when you properly envision what I have just said. You will then say to yourself, quote, "When I go out into nature, light and colors sparkle before me. As I absorb the light with its colors, I unite myself with that part of nature that it sends forth into the future. When I return to my study and think about nature and spin out laws about it, then I busy myself with that part of nature that continually dies." Unquote. In nature, dying and becoming are continuously interwoven. We comprehend dying because we carry in us a reflection of our prenatal life, the world of intellect, the world of thought, through which we can comprehend the dying that lies at the foundation of nature. We can understand that part of nature that will exist in the future because we can comprehend nature not only with our intellect and our life of thinking, but because we can grasp it with that part of ourselves that is will. If human beings were unable to attain something from their pre-earthly life throughout their earthly life, if they were unable to save something from their pre-earthly life that then becomes the life of thinking, they could never achieve freedom. Human beings would have a relationship only to death, and when they would want to free what relates only to dead nature, they would want to free something dying. If they wanted to use what connects them with nature as willing beings, then they would fall into a stupor, because everything that connects them with nature as willing beings is still a seed. They would be beings of nature, but not free beings. Above these two activities, the comprehension through the intellect of what is dead, and the comprehension through the will of what is living, is something that only human beings and no other earthly beings carry within themselves from birth until death. That is pure thinking, thinking unrelated to external nature, but related to the supersensible in human beings, to what makes human beings independent beings, and to something that is above the sub-dead and super-living. If we wish to speak of human freedom, then we must respect this aspect of autonomy in human beings. We must look at the pure sense-free thinking in which the will always lives. However, if you look at nature from this point of view, then you will say, quote, I look at nature, and the stream of dying is in me, as is the stream of new becoming, dying and being reborn, unquote. Modern science understands very little about that relationship, because for science, nature forms a unity, and dying and becoming are continuously mixed together. Today, much that scientists say about nature and the essence of nature is very confused, because dying and becoming are continuously mixed together. If you want to separate these two streams in a pure form, then you must ask yourself how nature would be if the human being did not exist. Modern science and its underlying philosophy are in an awkward position when faced with that problem. Imagine, if you will, that you ask a modern scientist how nature and the essence of nature would be if there were no human beings. The natural scientist would, of course, at first be shocked, since the question is so unusual. However, he or she would consider scientific information to answer the question and would say that then there would be minerals, plants, and animals on the earth, but no people. The course of the earth, from the very beginning, when it was still in the Comte-Laplace nebulous state, would have continued on just as it did, only the process would not have included humans. No other answer would be possible. The scientist could perhaps add that although people dig in the soil as farmers or construct machines to change the earth's surface and thereby effect changes, such changes are not very important compared with the changes brought forth by nature itself. Thus the scientist would, in principle, always say that minerals, plants, and animals would develop without the existence of people. This is incorrect. If the evolution of the earth did not include human beings, then most animals would not exist. A major portion of the animals, particularly the higher animals, arose within earthly evolution only because human beings needed to use their elbows. Of course, I speak here only pictorially. At a particular stage in their earthly development, human beings, to develop further, needed to rid their nature, At a particular stage in their earthly development, human beings, to develop further, needed to rid their nature, which then was much different than it is now, of the higher animals. We can perhaps comprehend this cleansing if we imagine how, in a mixture in which something is dissolved, the dissolved substance precipitates and falls. In the same way, human beings in an earlier stage of development were one with the animal world, and then the animal world precipitated out. In earthly development, animals would not have become what they are today had humanity not needed to become what it is now. Thus, without the inclusion of humanity in earthly development, animals and the earth itself would look much different than they do today. Let us now go on to the mineral and plant world. We must be quite clear that not only the lower animal forms, but also the plant and mineral world would have petrified long ago and ceased development were there no human beings on the earth. Here again, the modern worldview based upon a one-sided view of nature could only say that this is all well and good. People die and we cremate their bodies or bury them and thus give them over to the earth. However, that has no real meaning for earthly development, since if the earth were not to take human bodies into itself, its development would continue exactly in the same way. This worldview means, however, that people are totally unaware that the continuous giving over of human corpses to the earth, regardless of whether it occurs through cremation or burial, is a real process with continuous consequences. Farm wives are much more aware than city women that yeast has a certain meaning in baking bread, even though only a small amount is added. They know that bread could not rise if they did not add yeast to the dough. In the same way, earthly development would have long ago reached its final stages were the earth not continuously fed with the forces of human corpses. The forces released by the human spirit soul at death. The forces that earthly development continuously receives through the acceptance of human corpses, that is, the forces contained in those corpses, supports the evolution of the earth. Without the support of such forces today, minerals could no longer unfold the forces of crystallization. The minerals would otherwise have crumbled and dissolved long ago. Through such forces, plants that no longer could grow are able to grow today. It is the same with the lower animals. It is human beings who, through their bodies, provide the leaven, similar to yeast, for the earth's further development. Whether humanity lives upon the earth or not is not a question without meaning. It is simply not true that earthly development of the mineral, plant, and animal kingdoms would progress if human beings did not exist. The process of nature is a unified and closed process in which the human being belongs. We can properly picture the human being only when we think of humanity as standing, even in death, within the cosmic process. If you consider this, then it will be no surprise when I also say that the human being, stepping down from the spiritual world into the physical, is clothed with the physical body. Of course, the body is different when received as a child than when we lay it aside at some age through death. Something has happened with the body. What happens can only occur when human spiritual forces permeate this body. We all eat the same things animals eat. That is, we transform external material in the same way that animals transform it. However, we transform it under the influence of something animals do not have, something that comes down from the spiritual world to unite itself with the physical human body. Thus, we make something different than what plants or animals make with matter. The material in the human body that we give over to the earth at death is transformed matter, and is something different than what the human received at birth. The matter, and also the forces the human being receives at birth, are renewed during life and returned to the earth transformed. The matter and forces returned to the earth at death are not the same as those received at birth. Thus the human being returns to the earth something that continuously flows from the supersensible world into the physical sense-perceptible earthly process. Human beings bring something down from the supersensible world at birth that, together with the intake of matter and forces during their lifetime, joins with their body and is then given over to the earth at death. Thus the human provides a continuous trickle of the supersensible into the sensible and physical. You can easily understand that even if the supersensible constantly rained into the sensible, these drops would remain unfruitful for the earth if human beings did not first receive them and then convey them to the earth. These drops, which the human being begins to receive at birth and gives up at death, are a continuous fertilization of the earth by supersensible powers. Through that fertilization, the supersensible powers sustain the earth's evolutionary process. Without the human corpse, the earth would be long dead. Having said that, we may now ask what the forces of death have to do with human nature. Of course, the death-bringing forces that are continuously active in nature act also upon human nature. If human beings did not continuously enliven it, nature would die. How do these death-bringing forces act upon human nature? They act to bring forth all the human attributes that range from the skeletal structure to the nervous system. What forms the bones and all things connected with them has quite a different nature from what forms the other systems. The death-bringing forces act upon us, and when we leave them as they are, we become human bone. The death-bringing forces act upon us, and when we weaken them, we become human nerve. What is a nerve? A nerve is something that continuously desires to become bone and is hindered only by its connection to aspects of human nature that are part of neither the skeleton nor the nervous system. The nerve continuously attempts to harden and is continuously compelled to die, in the sense that human bones are dead, to a high degree. In animal bones, the situation is somewhat different in that they are much more alive than human bones. Thus we can imagine one side of human nature as the activity of the death-bringing stream upon the skeleton and nerve system. That is one pole. The other stream, the continuous life-giving forces, is active upon the muscles and blood and everything connected with them. The only reason the nerves do not become bones is that the forces active in the blood and muscles counteract this inclination. The nerve does not become bone because the blood and muscles oppose this and inhibit its calcification. Rickets, which is the hindrance of the proper dying of the bones by the blood and muscles, occurs when during growth an incorrect relationship exists between the bones on the one side and the blood and muscles on the other. It is thus extremely important to develop the proper interaction between the muscles and blood on the one side and the skeleton and nerves on the other. The capability of the I, EYE, to connect the essence of willing living in the muscles and blood with the wisdom lying in the bones and nerves arises because of the way the bones and nerves are related to the I, EYE. The bones withdraw and form a recess, leaving only their weakened form, the nerves, in the I, EYE. Here again we come to something that played a major role in older science, but that modern science laughs at as a childish idea. Nevertheless, modern science will again come back to it in a different form. The ancients always felt a relationship between the substance of the nerves and the substance of bones, and they believed that people thought with their bones as well as with their nerves. This is also true. We can thank the capacity of our skeletal system for everything we have in abstract science. For example, why can human beings develop geometry? The higher animals have no geometry. We can say that in their way of living. We can see that in their way of living. It is pure nonsense to say that perhaps the higher animals have geometry, but we do not notice it. Human beings create geometry. But how does the human being create the idea of a triangle, for example? If we really consider that human beings developed the idea of a triangle, we will find something marvelous. Out of their pure geometric imagination, human beings developed the triangle, which exists nowhere in concrete life. Much that is unknown about the heart of events in the world lies open to us. For example, assume you are standing in a particular place in this room. As a supersensible human being, at various times you make remarkable gestures of which you are normally unaware. For instance, you go a little to one side, and then a little to the other, and then you come back to where you originally were. You unconsciously move along a line in space that in reality forms a triangle. Such movements exist even though you do not perceive them. However, because your backbone is vertical, you live in the plane in which these movements occur. Animals do not live in this plane because their spinal cord lies differently, so that they do not carry out these movements. Because the human spinal cord is vertical, human beings live in the plane of this movement. Humans are not conscious of this. They do not say to themselves, quote, "I continuously dance in a triangle," unquote. However, they draw a triangle and say, quote, "This is a triangle," unquote. In truth, it is only a cosmic movement performed unconsciously. The movements you record in geometry when you draw geometrical figures are also performed by the earth. The earth has more movements than are ascribed to it by the Copernican point of view. It continuously performs other quite artistic movements. Still more complicated movements occur, for example, those of the geometric solids, the cube, the octahedron, the dodecahedron. These solids are not fantasies. They are real, but unconscious. In subconscious human knowledge, there are remarkable resonances with them and with other forms. Our skeleton has considerable knowledge, but because we cannot reach down into the skeleton with our consciousness, our awareness of that knowledge fades and is reflected only in the geometric pictures drawn by human beings. The human being is directly coupled to the cosmos, and with the development of geometry, something the human being does in the cosmos is modeled. Here we see on the one side a world that surrounds us and is continuously dying. On the other, we see something that enters into the forces of our blood and muscles and is in continuous movement, in continuous fluctuation, in continuous becoming and creation, something always an embryo in which nothing is dead. We slow the process of dying within us, as only we human beings can slow it, and bring into it the process of creation. If human beings did not exist on earth, then this dying would have long ago spread over the earth, and the earth would have become a great crystallized form. Individual crystals would no longer survive. We tear the individual crystals from the great process of crystallization and retain them so long as we need them for our human development. Thus we also sustain activity in the life of the earth. People sustain the life of the earth, and thus they cannot be disconnected from the life of the earth. Out of his pessimism, Edward von Hartmann had a real thought that one day humanity would be so mature that all people would kill themselves. We need not even add that what Hartmann, due to the limitations of his scientific point of view, wanted. Because he was not satisfied with all people killing themselves, he also wanted to blow up the earth. He did not need to add this. He needed only to designate the day of the great suicide, and the earth would have slowly destroyed itself. Earthly development cannot continue without what human beings implant in the earth. We must allow this knowledge to permeate our feeling. We must understand these things now. Perhaps you recall that in my earliest writings, a recurring thought was that I wanted to base knowledge upon something other than the current thinking. In Anglo-American philosophy, the human being is only an observer of the world. Humans, with their inner soul process, are simply observers of the world. In that line of thinking, if human beings did not exist, and if their souls did not relive what occurs in the outside world, everything would still be as it is. People thought that point of view was as valid for the natural scientific developments I have just discussed as it was for philosophy. Modern philosophers are quite comfortable as world observers. That is quite comfortable in the dying element of cognition. I wanted to guide cognition out of this dying element. Therefore, I have always repeated that the human being is not simply an observer of the world. Rather, the human being is the world stage upon which the great cosmic events play again and again. I have always said that human beings with their soul life are the stage upon which world events play. That is one way we can express this view in a philosophical, abstract form. In the final chapter of my book, Truth and Knowledge, I emphasize that we cannot find an equivalent in the remainder of nature for what occurs in human beings. Let me say that again. In the final chapter of my book, Truth and Knowledge, I emphasize that we cannot find an equivalent in the remainder of nature for what occurs in human beings. The remainder of nature, which is at the same time a cosmic process, enters the human being. The human soul is a stage upon which not simply a human, but a cosmic process plays out. Today that is difficult for many people to understand. However, unless you penetrate such views, it is impossible to be a good teacher. What really happens in human beings? On the one hand, we have the skeletal nerve activity, and on the other, the blood muscle activity. The interaction of these two continuously creates matter and energy anew. The earth is saved from death, because human beings create matter and energy. Now you can connect what I just said, namely, that the blood, through its connection with the nerves, acts to create matter and energy, with what I said in the last lecture, that the blood is continuously on the path toward spirituality and meets resistance there. We will further connect these two thoughts and build upon them. However, you can already see how erroneous the commonly held idea of the conservation of energy and matter is, since what occurs within the human being refutes it. As normally presented, It is only an obstacle for a real understanding of the human being. Something fertile for science can be achieved only when people replace their thoughts on the conservation of energy and matter with the synthetic thought that although nothing can come from nothing, something can be so transformed that it ceases to exist and something else arises. You see how much of our thinking goes in the wrong direction. We formulate, for example, something like the law of conservation of energy and matter and proclaim it as a law of nature. This is the result of a certain tendency in our ideas, or more generally in our soul life, toward a one-sided description of things, whereas we should only postulate from our developed ideas rather than proclaim laws. Thus you can find, for example, in physics books, the law of impermeability. At a point in space where one body exists, another cannot exist at the same time. This is stated as a general characteristic of bodies. However, what we should say is that those bodies are, or beings are impermeable whose nature is such that where they are in space, no other being of the same nature can be at the same time. Let me read that sentence again. However, what we should say is that those bodies or beings are impermeable whose nature is such that where they are in space, no other being of the same nature can be at the same time. We should use concepts only to separate one area from another. We should only set up postulates and not give definitions that claim to be universal. Thus, we should not form a law of conservation of energy and matter, but rather seek the beings for which this law has meaning. In the 19th century, there was a particular striving to create laws and then claim them to be valid for everything, instead of using the life of the soul to approach and observe things as we experience them. The end of Lecture 3.